The stories that we take into ourselves deeply, the ones that we ingest, I'm going to say, inform the way we imagine and move through the world. And so what I was just saying about hegemonic belief and how incredibly complicated it can be to challenge hegemonic belief in ourselves or in contexts that we're in, is connected to that. When we take things into ourselves to the degree that they help, they become lodestars, they become compass points, they become ways we navigate the world, those things are not, they don't have one root. They have lots of roots. And when we challenge them or try to change them, we pull on one piece and all of a sudden we feel we have this, if it was an internal physical image, I'd pull on one part and feel like some other part twitched, you know? Like I didn't realize this was connected to that. And you start to have this experience, like all these things are connected to one another. This is going to be really complicated. And so whenever we consider a re-understanding of something, it's challenging. And I should say right at the start of this talky bit that although I believe what I just said, I don't believe that this means that stories are static. I don't think that they stayed the way we were when we first met them. Nor do I believe that the stories that we've ingested are meant to keep saying the same things to us. Again, that contextual belief, our context changes. And so if the stories that guide our lives don't evolve, that's a clue that we're resisting something essential to being a vital human. And that something, I would say, if I wanted a simple word for it, I would say that that something is change. And that's an easy thing to say fast. But it can be really challenging to live into because change is, as anyone who's ever done it will tell you, is painful stuff. We don't tend to change until the perceived pain of change is less than the perceived pain of not changing. So we tend to change, you know, under duress, generally speaking. Not always, but it takes a little bit of compelling, I think, sometimes to get into that space. But that said, change we must. If we don't change, we do tend to wither and die. We tend to get locked into a place that we've been and not be able to get out. Even when it becomes very clear to us that we really, truly need to. There are lots of us in this room that have grown up soaking in a view of the Bible, of Christianity's sacred text, that has included the tenet that the goal of that sacred text is to provide us with an unchangeable picture of an unchanging deity and subsequently an unchanging faith. And I don't think that's a very helpful picture of the Bible, nor do I believe it's an accurate or a defensible one. And so, of course, it follows that I don't really think that's a helpful way to think about the divine either. I don't think that's a helpful way to think about God. As though if we could just get our understanding of God squared away, then our goal forward would be to make sure nothing and no one ever changed that understanding. I think about all I'm going to have time to do with this idea this morning is just sort of stir it up, and then next week we're going to unpack it a little bit more. But we'll circle back to it. But my hope, as always, is that the next few minutes of your life are going to be ones that get you churning on something that the churn of which far outlasts these few minutes that we have together on a Sunday morning. My hope is always that the things that get stirred up in these talky bits are catalysts and that they're catalysts for change and catalysts for evolution in our personal experience and in our experiences together and in our spiritual explorations in general. So here's what I want to do. I want to read us a little bit of the Genesis narrative, particularly the bit where Adam and Eve move out of paradise and into the real world. The phrase "the real world," by the way, is becoming part of our cultural language in a way that it wasn't even a decade ago. Right? Like this idea that there's a virtual world and the real world has become such a prevalent split experience of worlds that emerging generations use the real world as a defining phrase that's meant to set aside other things. It's really kind of a fascinating linguistic thing that's happening. But anyway.
Real world and fantasy world.
Yeah, real world, fantasy world, or real world, virtual world as well, you know. But the contrast of this is the real world now, you know. Among other things, I think, speaks to how absorbing the not-real world has become. My hope is that the things we're messing with apply to the real world well. So I want to read you a little bit of that story, and I use the phrase "the real world" there on purpose. That's why I wanted to say something about it. And then I want to read you a piece by a novelist that in many ways I think deals with the same ideas, but from a decidedly 21st century perspective. And then next week I want to unpack the application of that novelist's work to that ancient story a little bit more. So just the stories mostly this morning, because that's about what we'll have time for. So this is from Genesis 3. The serpent was clever. I love this story right out of the chute because we talk about not real world. I mean, we got it all here, right? We got, you know, magic trees and talking snakes and like the whole thing's it's pretty great. The serpent was clever, more clever than any wild animal God had made. He spoke to the woman. Do you understand that God has told you not to eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, not at all. We can eat from the trees in the garden. It's only about the tree in the middle of the garden that God said, don't eat from it. Don't even touch it or you'll die. So they're just taking turns amping up what they know. It's a fascinating beginning because first the serpent, you know, ramps it up to don't eat from any tree, and then the person that the human they're talking to ramps it up to don't even touch it. Like, you know, not in the original kind of narrative structure. So it's a fascinating thing going on there that we're not going to explore. The serpent told the woman, you won't die. God knows the moment you eat from that tree, you'll see what's really going on. You'll be just like God, knowing everything, ranging from all the way from good to evil. When the woman saw that the tree looked like good eating and realized what she would get out of it, she'd know everything, she took and ate the fruit and then gave some to her husband and he ate too. Immediately, the two of them did see what's really going on. They saw themselves naked. They sewed fig leaves together as makeshift clothes for themselves. When they heard the sound of God strolling in the garden in the evening breeze, the man and his wife hid in the trees of the garden, hid from God. And then we get in the story, I won't take the time to read the detail of it. Many of us are familiar, but what we get is like all these cascading excuses, right? We get the domino excuses. The woman gave it to me. The serpent seduced me. And it's just like everybody's trying to hand it off. And then we get the curses. Serpent has to crawl in the dirt. The woman has pain in childbirth. Man has work that's just as painful as childbirth. There's a narrative that only a patriarchal society could have had the nerve to float, right? Anyway, and then we get this. God said, this is great, like just listen to this. I love this translation of this text. God said, the human has become like one of us, capable of knowing everything, ranging from good to evil. What if they now should reach out and take fruit from the tree of life and eat and live forever? Never. This cannot happen. Is that the voice of the divine you're familiar with hearing in that text? So God expelled them from the Garden of Eden and sent them to work the ground, the same dirt out of which they'd been made. He threw them out of the garden and stationed angel cherubim and a revolving sword of fire east of it, guarding the path to the tree of life. Okay, so, whew, okay, Tim, so many things you could, anyway, we're not going there. We're just mostly going to park it except for this. So you've probably heard that described at some point in your life as the story of the fall or something similar, a pretty common way to read it. The humans are in paradise. They break the one rule that God gave them. God is upset, kicks them out forever. An alternative reading with just a little more nuance, humans are living someplace where everything is awesome, even the work, because right from the start in this story, there's work. They have this task of caring for all of creation and making something beautiful of it. But as they mature, they become less satisfied with their limitations. They want to know everything, which bugs God, and so he forces them to move along. And there are, of course, many ways to read any story, including the Genesis one. And what I want to do this morning is set up a reading of that story that might invite a reconsideration of some of our more established notions about being compelled to move along, or to be what the author of this next piece calls migrants. So we have increasingly nuanced language for humans on the move as we're more and more conscious of the massive movement of humans in our time. And so the word that this writer chooses and that I want us to be conscious of, its limitations as well as application, is migrants. So not immigrants, not emigres, not refugees particularly, but migrants, all right? This piece is actually from the 2019, August 2019 National Geographic. The author is Mohsin Hamid. Hamid is a British-Pakistani novelist and a brand consultant. This guy has a pretty interesting personal story. He like, works 3 days a week for this huge brand consultancy, so he has the other days to write. Must have a bit of a bifurcated world. Born in Lahore, Pakistan, grew up partly there, partly in the U.S. His father was attending a major American school working on their doctorate at the time, so they lived where their family lived. But personally, Hamid is a graduate of Princeton and Harvard Law School. And in 2013, he was named one of the world's 100 leading global thinkers by Foreign Policy magazine. So an interesting kind of framework, personally, for someone who thinks of themselves primarily as a novelist. Most recent novel is Exit West, which is about a young couple, Nadia and Saeed, and their relationship in a time where the world is taken by storm by migrants. That book was shortlisted for the 2017 Man Booker Prize, which is one of the more prestigious literary awards in the Western world. It's called We Are All Migrants. In a world of distractions, I want to encourage you to pay close attention, because this is packed with big ideas, beautifully given to us, but there's lots in here. All of us are descended from migrants. Our species, Homo sapiens, did not evolve in Lahore, where I am writing these words, nor did we evolve in Shanghai or Topeka or Buenos Aires or Cairo or Oslo, where you perhaps are reading them. Even if you live today in the Rift Valley, in Africa, mother continent to us all, on the site of the earliest discovered remains of our species, your ancestors, too, moved. They left, changed, and intermingled before returning to the place you live now, just as I left Lahore, lived for decades in North America and Europe, and returned to reside in the house where my grandparents and parents once did, the house where I spent much of my childhood, seemingly indigenous, but utterly altered and remade by my travels. None of us is a native of the place we call home. And none of us is a native to this moment in time. We are not native to the instant already gone when the sentence began to be written, nor to the instant also gone when it began to be read, nor even to this moment now, which we enter for the first time and which slips away, has slipped away, is irrevocably lost, except from memory. To be human is to migrate forward through time, the seconds like islands, where we arrive, castaways, and from which we are swept off by the tide, arriving again and again in a new instant on a new island, one we have, as always, never experienced before. Over the course of a life, these migrations through the seconds accrue, transform into hours, months, decades. We become refugees from our childhoods. The schools, the friends, the toys, the parents that made up our worlds, all gone, replaced by new buildings, by phone calls, photo albums, and reminiscences. We step onto our streets looking up at the towering figures of adults. We step out again a little later and attract the gazes of others with our youth, and later still with our own children or those of our friends, and then, once more, seemingly invisible, no longer of much interest, bowed by gravity. We all experience the constant drama of the new and the constant sorrow of the loss of what we've left behind. I'm going to read that sentence again. We all experience the constant drama of the new and the constant sorrow of the loss of what we've left behind. It is a universal sorrow, and one so potent that we seek to deny it, rarely acknowledging it in ourselves, let alone in others. We're encouraged by society to focus only on the new, on acquisition, rather than on the loss that is the other thread uniting and binding our species. We move when it is intolerable to stay where we are. We move because of environmental stresses and physical dangers and the small-mindedness of our neighbors, and to be who we wish to be, to seek what we wish to seek. We move through time, through the temporal world, because we are compelled to. We move through space, through the physical world, seemingly because we choose to, but in those choices there are compulsions as well. We move when it is intolerable to stay where we are, when we cannot linger a moment longer alone in our stifling bedroom and must go outside and play, when we cannot linger a moment longer hungry on our parched farm and must go elsewhere for food. We move because of environmental stresses and physical dangers and the small-mindedness of our neighbors, and to be who we wish to be, to seek what we wish to seek. Ours is a migratory species. Humans have always moved. Our ancestors did. And not linearly, like an army advancing out of Africa in a series of bold thrusts, but circuitously, sometimes in one direction, then in another, borne along by currents both without and within. Our contemporaries are moving. above all from the countryside to the cities of Asia and Africa. And our descendants will move too. They will move as the climate changes, as sea levels rise, as wars are fought, as one mode of economic activity dies out and gives way to another. The power of our technology, its impact on our planet, is growing. Consequently, the pace of change is accelerating, giving rise to new stresses, and our nimble species will use movement as part of its response to these stresses, as our great-grandmothers and great-grandfathers did, as we are designed to do. And yet, we are told that such movement is unprecedented, that it represents a crisis, a flood, a disaster. We are told that there are two kinds of humans, natives and migrants, and that these must struggle for supremacy. We are told not only that movement through geographies can be stopped, but that movement through time can be too, that we can return to the past, to a better past, when our country, our race, our religion was truly great. All we must accept is division, the division of humanity into natives and migrants. Vision of a world of walls and barriers and of guards and weapons and surveillance required to enforce those barriers, a world where privacy dies and dignity and equality alongside it, and where humans must pretend to be static, unmoving, moored to the land on which they currently stand and to a time like the time of their childhood or their ancestors' childhood. An imaginary time in which standing still is only an imaginary possibility. Such are the dreams of a species defeated by nostalgia, at war with itself, with its migratory nature, and the nature of its relationship to time, screaming in denial of the constant movement that is human life. Perhaps thinking of us all as migrants offers us a way out of this looming dystopia. If we are all migrants, then possibly there is a kinship between the suffering of the woman who has never lived in another town and yet has come to feel foreign on her own street, and the suffering of the man who has left his town and will never see it again. Maybe transience is our mutual enemy. Not in the sense that the passage of time can be defeated, but rather in the sense that we all suffer from the losses time inflicts. A greater degree of compassion for ourselves might then become possible, and out of it, a greater degree of compassion for others. We might muster more courage as we swim through time rather than giving in to fear. We might collectively be able to be brave enough to recognize that our individual endings are not the ending of everything, and that beauty and hope remain possible even once we are gone. Accepting our reality as a migratory species will not be easy. New art, new stories, and new ways of being will be needed. But the potential is great. A better world is possible, a more just and inclusive world. Better for us and for our grandchildren, with better food and better music and less violence, too. That sentence makes me grin every time I read it because I'm like, better music? I don't know. How did that get in there? There's something going on in this story that I didn't get, but I like it every time. The city nearest you was, 2 centuries ago, almost unimaginably different from that city today. 2 centuries in the future, it is likely to be at least as different again. Few citizens of almost any city now would prefer to live in their city of 2 centuries ago. We should have the confidence to imagine that the same will be true of the citizens of the world's cities 2 centuries hence. A species of migrants, at last comfortable with being a species of migrants. That, for me, is a destination worth wandering to. It is the central challenge and opportunity every migrant offers us to see in him, in her, in them, the reality of ourselves. The end. Pretty interesting piece, hey? Not going to say anything about it today. That's next week. Except that we're going to plug that into Genesis. And I'm going to try to successfully contend that it's the original story about what this novelist is talking about. All right. Peace.